I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin.
It's fabulous to be here, Michael.
So much going on. It seems to me today, just to give our listeners a little bit of a heads up, we might talk about the future of nuclear subs and long-range missiles for Australia, whether Joe might run again, whether Tucker might run and beat him, what Z and X might have talked about, fighting in Sudan. I've got this book, Martin, General Gordon of Sudan from the 19th century. Will they ever stop fighting? Is Dan Andrews actually running the country? I guess we might find out later today. And might the state government and Mark McGowan need to go into the business of brickmaking? But let's start at the very beginning. We had the big announcement since we last met on the defence front. A couple of people in defence, no doubt, are unhappy with the reorientation of our armed forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, some political pushback. What are the key features, Martin, and does it make sense to you?
Whilst I'm not a defence analysis, so analyst, can't answer some of those questions, but what I can talk about is the politics of this, which is quite fascinating, and some of the broader things that they talked about in the report and how that feeds in. So the report says basically that we're unprepared for the different types of challenges that we have. So it's been fascinating reading these reports over the years, because sometimes they've talked about the threat of terrorism and the need for special forces. Now we're going back to the more of the old school, we need to defend our shores. And the defence report says that we're not particularly well calibrated to defend the northern coast and the northern area. And so there's a large emphasis on sea and air defence in this particular document. And it has some interesting ramifications for Western Australia, because the Learmonth and Curtin bases to our north would both get an upgrade, I'd imagine, based on the findings of this report. So there'll be money that are poured into the northern part of Australia in a defence sense. There's a lot of investment that would be needed to give life to this report. And bear in mind, we've just had these huge announcements for submarines, but there's a fair bit of other investment envisaged. And then that will lead to all of those usual conversations. If you're going to invest a ton of money here, what's that mean for the budget, and will other areas of services miss out? So a really lot of interesting issues there.
It really is interesting, isn't it? We've got these nuclear-powered submarines in prospect. We're going to have the Virginia-class nuclear submarines from the US visiting. They already are at Garden Island, HMAS Stirling, and that's our future. I might just remind listeners that I recently interviewed Commander Peter Scott of the RAN, now retired, who is one of the top commanders of our submarine fleet. He's just written a book called Running Deep, which is, if you ever imagined you might have liked to be on a submarine as a career, would either endorse the dream or put you off it forever. But I talked to Peter about this very topic of the nuclear-powered submarines, and I'd suggest people have a listen. It's quite interesting. The capacity to be long-range, to be down underneath, to be an effective strike weapon, obviously appeals to a lot of people, and having extra long-range missiles. But the question I'm interested in, when you look at our track record, where we've had the DIBS report, we've had top people around the country like Hugh White analysing our strategies for years. People come, people go, and so do the reviews and the reports. Do you reckon we'll see another report in 10 or 15 years and we decide to do something else? Who knows?
It's hard to predict. Yeah, a lot keeps on changing. There's often implicit and occasionally explicit mentions of China's military buildup here, and China's buildup did get a mention here, so it's in part a reflection on that. So the Asia Pacific is being seen in some ways, because of the South China Sea and Taiwan and other issues, as a potential flashpoint for military confrontation. And that's feeding into this sense as well. So Our defense reports will always be responses to the broader geopolitical environment, really. And we can expect probably some more changes in tone and sentiment 5 or 10 years down the track.
I guess we'll also find out in the budget that we'll talk about that next week, Martin, just how much money is being put into these new programs. But switching focus, do you think Joe and Kamala will actually get to run again?
Well, he certainly intends to. He's put his hand up, and it's very, very rare for sitting presidents to get knocked off in a primary. So, and there doesn't seem to be much appetite amongst the Democrats to really contest. There are a couple of contestants. There's Robert Kennedy Jr., who's an interesting guy, comes from a really famous political family, but he's anti-vaxxer. It's not going to go down well with the Democrat base at all. So he's a bit quirky in that respect. I can't see a lot of challenges at the moment emerging to take on Joe Biden, which, so it seems like that he might have a clear run the second at standing for a second term.
Another person who's made a lot of news lately that many Australians won't be overly familiar with is Tucker Carlson. He's just left the Fox network. He made a big name for himself there. He apparently didn't believe a word of the claims that the election had been stolen. He also seemed to have harsh words for a range of people. But he's built up a huge following. And given Trump got the presidency, can you imagine someone like Tucker Carlson thinking, I might as well run for the job?
It's weird, it's crazy, it would be extraordinary, but nothing's out of the question in US politics these days. I thought it would have been astonishing for Donald Trump to run before 2016. I thought he'd just keep talking about it and probably never do it, but lo and behold, he did it and won. So I think you can't dismiss anything out of hand. He's got the money, he's got the resources, he's got a huge audience. He's got that sort of shtick, the Trump outsider shtick, and taking on the elites. And you can say what you want to say if you vote for me. You can be who you want to be if you vote for me. All those other people trying to shut you down, don't listen to them. He's very good at that kind of thing. He's very good at making grey things and complex things seem black and white. So, look, it wouldn't be a complete surprise, put it that way.
Would he run as an independent?
No, he'd run for the Republicans, I imagine. Yeah, and if, of course, if he's running in the Republican primaries, he'll run straight against Donald Trump, which would be rather fascinating, seeing the two of them go head-to-head. And there's, you know, others such as Ron DeSantis, who's lost a bit of traction lately, but, you know, he's got the thing about Tucker Carlson, he's got that cut-through that Trump had. So, you know, like I said, you can't rule anything out in US politics. It would be strange, weird, but it could happen.
Speaking about cut through, I mentioned Z and X earlier, referring, of course, to Zelensky and Xi, the leaders of Ukraine and China seem actually to have talked. Do you think they did? How would they have conversed? And what do you think they might have talked about? And Martin, does it matter anyway?
Look, it's kind of interesting because I think China is genuinely trying to be a peacemaker in this conflict, and which is interesting because you've got the US on one side that's arming and strategizing for Ukraine. You've got Russia that's pouring enormous amounts of resources in there. And, you know, there's going to need to be a diplomatic or a political solution at some stage. So China's role is quite interesting. But whilst Russia and the US are both pouring huge amounts of resources into this, and whilst there's a lot at stake for both parties, it's hard to see a peace agreement coming anytime soon. So people have to listen to China because they're a really heavyweight. But whether it will actually break through, I'm not entirely sure at this stage. Maybe down the track, perhaps.
Do we have any sense of what China might be saying to Ukraine?
China has released a plan for peace, and involves a ceasefire and then further discussions following that. It hasn't specified what the end game would be. And that's actually correct, because if you try to specify what the end game will be, people argue over the end game. who gets what, and you know whether Russia is allowed to stay in any part of Ukraine and, or Crimea or whatever. I think the first thing they need to do is lay down arms, and then maybe try and work through a solution after that. I think China's broadly on the right track there, but like I said, there's a fairly entrenched positions that Russia has, and of course Ukraine that has successfully defended their turf largely, and are not that likely to agree to any deal that sees Russia remaining.
Martin, talking about laying down arms, it doesn't look like it's quite happening yet, although there are attempts to lay down arms in Khartoum and in Sudan generally. I'm in possession of a book entitled In Africa with the Union Jack that my grandfather gave me when I was eight, and his father gave him when he was about eight, and it includes General Gordon of Khartoum, as the British like to talk to him. They were there fighting in Africa, fighting in Sudan. It looks to me and sounds to me and feels to me as though people have been fighting in Sudan forever. Will it ever finish?
Well, there were some temporary ceasefires, but I think that they're far from coming to an actual peace agreement there. So what you've got is you've got two essential factions of the military. Al-Bashir was this dictator in Sudan, and there was an awful civil conflict and human rights abuses, etc., under his reign. And he tried to prevent a coup by having his regular army with its leadership and having a paramilitary group, a militia, with its own leadership as well. So, you know, to sort of play them off against each other. Eventually, they actually united and both turfed him. But there's always been these, since that time, there's been these two different factions, both with their own leadership, who have worked together to run the country as a military dictatorship, effectively. And now there's discussions about going to a civil government, and unresolved is who will lead the government, who will lead the military, how it will be integrated together. And there's some old scores and rivalries that might be settled. So it's broken down completely, and we've got effectively a blue-on-blue war between the Sudanese factions. And I think that there's a lot of danger here that it could spread to other areas and surrounding. It's a very volatile part of Africa, that. It's got, if you look at the surrounding countries all around Sudan, practically all of them have had civil disturbances. So it could get messy if it doesn't clear up soon.
We're lucky to live in a country where civil conflict of that sort hasn't happened, and hopefully never will. Perhaps if there's any question of any insurrection, they'll send it immediately to the National Cabinet that we formed back at the beginning of the pandemic. Martin, it's meeting today as we speak, and apparently Dan Andrews, the Victorian Premier's hot to trot on Medicare. What's happening then? And it rather suggests the National Cabinet's not sort of done just yet.
Well, a National Cabinet is an opportunity for the Premiers to really put the heat on the Prime Minister and try to go cap in hand for a better deal and more funding in a whole range of areas. And the big discussion, we're told today, will be around health. And front and centre is the role of GPs there, and access to GPs. And if you listen to Premiers, they see that primary care, keeping people out of hospital, is the key to resolving this, which is why Medicare, which underpins that primary care model, is the focus of Daniel Andrews. But I think that he'll probably get some support from other premiers in this. And of course, the interesting thing is we're talking practically all Labor, Labor Prime Minister, Labor premiers. So I think the rhetoric will be toned down somewhat. Sometimes it can get a little bit heated or volatile. The only Liberal in the room will be Jeremy Rockliffe from Tasmania, but all the rest of them will be Labor prime ministers and premiers this time.
I suppose Mark McGowan from Western Australia, our state premier, might want to think of putting in a bid for an extra cut of the GST share, Martin, so he can go into the brick-making business. People will be all aware that just yesterday, WA's embattled construction industry has claimed another scalp with Australia's largest brick manufacturer mothballing its last WA factory, as WA Today reported yesterday. Would there be a temptation for the state to sort of become an equity partner in brick making like they are arguably in other areas?
Look, I think that would still be a surprise, but really it's astonishing, isn't it, to see that this is occurring. We've got big problems in the construction industry already. This is not going to help. We're told problems both with in terms of getting the right labour there, and then the second problem is getting the right materials. And that latter problem is not going to be resolved by this. And I think the problem with getting the right materials has been exacerbated by the right labour. So, you know, they're actually interlinked. And then, of course, because the problems in the construction industry, we can't build enough houses, and that leads to high levels of homelessness, really high rents, extremely difficult in terms of the cost of living. So there's a lot of flow-on effects to this, and getting this right will be really, really crucial.
It really is a tough one, but it doesn't matter who you talk to. You keep coming back to housing, whether it's housing construction, whether it's sort of middle-class people getting their homes built, whether it's provisions of proper housing, social housing to people. And tied to that, Martin, I simply wouldn't talk about the budget, but if you had to put some money, wager whether the job seeker allowance will after all go up, what do you reckon?
I think probably not, just because the government keeps on telling us they won't do it. So there'd have to be a major backflip to do it. And so because they're under pressure, of course, they're looking for some alternative options. And one of them might be more unwinding that change to the single parent benefit that occurred, where it was cut off above 8-year-olds rather than cut off above 12-year-olds. So basically, they would be providing that benefit for a longer period of time. A lot of people thought that was really unfair at the time, and it was making it a challenging situation for a number of families worse. And that happened under the Gillard era. So that there's talk that might actually be a change that might help some families in certain situations. Certainly, there's plenty of heat in some quarters to try and raise that job seeker allowance, because it was much higher under COVID. And then people will tell you in the NGO area, Michael, it made a massive difference. Having a better job seeker payment really did help people get by. But I can't see it happening myself.
Well, as I say, you can lay your bets. We'll know soon enough what's going to be in the budget. It's going to be one of the most interesting in quite some time. Martin, we've managed to keep View Today Trump-free. We've also managed to avoid talking about The Voice. The campaigns are underway. Lots of money coming in to support them, particularly on the Yes side. So we'll come back to those two topics, I'm sure, in the next week or two. But for today, thank you for joining me.
It's been my pleasure, and look forward to the next conversation.